Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It is a Food Friday. Cheese is one of the most fascinating and versatile types of food we eat. There are endless ways to sell it, prepare it, and eat it. We love it so much, we decided to do another show about it. So here we are with an expert cheesemaker and dairy farmer in the studio with us today to answer your questions about cheese. Longtime cheese lover and aficionado of animal husbandry, Max Breiteneicher learned from the masters at various farms around the region. He and his wife Amy run Grace Hill Farm in Cummington, Massachusetts. With the help of their cows, the use of some high-tech cheese-making gadgets, and even a cheese cave, they make fresh artisanal cheese and they sell it around the region. So without further ado, it's time to say cheese. And I apologize for that. I didn't write the script. Number to call is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. You can also comment on our Facebook page, facebook.com/WAMC Radio, or tweet us at WAMC Vox Pop. Why, you can even email us, voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number to call is 800-348-2551. Max Breiteneicher, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ray. It's great to be here.
Now, I must say your last name is multisyllabic. I will be saying it wrong at least three times during the program.
You've done pretty well so far.
All right, so far, but it's very early. So you're fairly new to this game.
More or less, yeah. We just entered our second full year.
How did you come to this point in your life?
I ask myself that often, right?
Well,
I've sort of always worked in small-scale agriculture since, you know, I think my first job was on a cranberry bog in Duxbury, Mass. And,
no, that's a nice job.
Yeah, that was actually really fun. And primarily with vegetables, but in 2004, I had the opportunity to intern at a place called Jasper Hill Farm in Greensboro, Vermont, who are excellent cheesemakers and sort of really well-known now. At that point, they were at the end of their first year as well. And they had similarly to us sort of built a cheese facility and aging space. And so I just really got to see that process. I got to learn from them about cheesemaking. They had cheesemaker there, Mateo, had studied in Europe and Spain for about 5 years. So he had a lot of sort of old world knowledge.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was just an amazing experience. And it just really stuck with me in terms of just really liking cows and really liking the cheesemaking process. And I've always sort of had a love of cheese. So although when Amy and I were looking to actually start our own farm, which has, again, sort of always been our dream, it just seemed like a perfect opportunity for us to combine those things.
So you and Amy bought a piece of property, no farm on it, and you started literally from scratch.
Yeah, we really started from scratch. I mean, it had been a dairy farm and a sheep farm probably maybe 80 years or so before we bought it. But nothing was really extant anymore. It still had some fields, some of which were very overgrown, or were at least. Had this really crazy old house on it.
So, I mean, to hit the ground running and 2 years later making some really great cheese, there must have been a lot of work getting that facility together.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as I said, we've just been climbing very steep learning curves for the past 2 years.
Where did you get – so you worked at some – dairy farms and some cheese-making operations.
Yeah.
And where did you get all the knowledge where you can say, well, I need to put this here,
yeah,
and the cows have to go here? and how did you learn all that stuff?
Yeah, no, sure. I mean, I think in part just by doing it, in part when we were actually building our facility and barn and stuff, I went to the places I'd worked, namely Jasper Hill Farm and a place called Chase Hill Farm in Warwick, Mass. Also Side Hill Farm, which is now in Hawley, Mass. And essentially asked them if they could start over, how would they do it? And so everyone gave me a lot of sort of well-worn advice from them.
So you've learned from everyone's mistakes.
Exactly,
but
yeah.
But you're making your own, I assume, yeah, right?
By the moment.
Well, there you go. And one of them is appearing here on this program. Yeah. We'll hope to limit the damage.
Yeah. So anyway, I was basically able to profit from their experience and sort of ease that process. And not that it was very simple or anything. It was incredibly complex, but it actually worked out quite well. And in part, we were really blessed in this process to be sort of aided and abetted by the major regulatory agencies who are in charge of these sorts of things. So like the state, Mass State Board of Health, a woman named Ellen Fitzgibbons there, who's a wonderful person, was able to actually consult on the construction of our facility so that, you know, we're across the board compliant with all that stuff, with both FDA and state rules.
There must be a lot of red tape.
There's a decent amount of things that need to happen. Yeah, that's really true. But also our town, Cummington, was amazingly supportive. And that, you know, as I found with other people trying to start operations like this, that can really sink a startup if the town, because the town's sort of the first line of defense in terms regulatorily. So they can really sink something if they don't want to deal with it because it just gets passed off to the state and that's a lot harder. But anyway, yeah, our town was just hugely behind us and, you know, all of our neighbors help in various ways. And yeah, it's really been great.
So you have how many cows?
We have 9 cows now. Nine cows, yeah.
And are they tough to get along with?
No, they're all very sweet.
Oh, they are?
Yeah, super sweet. I mean, we actually just got rid of a cow in December or so, who was also very sweet, but she was really only the only problematic cow.
Oh, troublemaker, now, backstabber?
No, she's more just like a little neurotic, maybe.
Really?
Yeah, very. She's kind.
I know cats could be neurotic from this program, but no, cows as well.
Cows as well. Yeah, I mean, it depends on how we bought her from another farm when we started, basically. But yeah, it depends on their like early experience, really. And you know, she wasn't neurotic in any just hugely destructive way or anything. It was just kind of annoying. Like she needed to stand in certain places. And like if that didn't happen,
one of those troublemakers.
Yeah, no, exactly.
I dig it.
Oh yeah.
Our guest today is Max Breiteneicher of Grace Hill Farm in Cummington. We talk cheese on Food Friday. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. And well, let's take a call. Let's go to Bernice in Middleburg. You're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
So, my husband is extremely sensitive to lactose.
Oh, boy.
And we did learn from another dairy farmer that cheddar cheese, because of the process that makes cheddar cheese, is virtually lactose-free. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you might have any knowledge about other hard cheeses. I've heard varying reports about Swiss cheese and Havarti and other things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's sort of, so the lactose thing is, it's sort of described usually in really broad terms, but, and that is true about cheddar usually, and it's not necessarily because of the process, but it's more the aging time. So generally in any normal size, normal processed cheese, anything over 120 days is going to be free of lactose.
Really?
Yeah, that's because what the cultures that you add that make the cheese, the culture, the milk, they consume lactose and they make lactic acid. You know, it's like fermenting beer or something. They consume the sugars and then they make what you want in the cheese. And so with any normal sized wheel, like, you know, I don't know, between 10 and 40 pound wheel of cheese, as long as it doesn't have an extremely small amount of starter culture in it, all the lactose is gone by about 120 days.
That's amazing to hear. I did not know that.
And so generally, when people ask me about this, I just say, like, you know, you can usually see on the cheese type how long it's aged. And so anything over 4 months, it should be totally fine. But that said, if you want to be like really safe, you know, you get a year old cheddar, you know, a 12-month Gouda or something, there's no risk of there being lactose in that, really.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thanks, Bernice. Well, that's something I did not know. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. We're joined today by Max Breiteneicher of Grace Hill Farm in Cummington, Massachusetts. So how long do you age most of your cheeses?
It depends on the type. So right now we have 5 types that we make. We have a blue. We have a Alpine, which is like a Gruyere style. We have something called a Valais, which is a Raclette style. And then we also make a cloth-bound cheddar. And then seasonally, we make these little soft mold-ripened cheeses called Chaosses. But those, the soft ones go, we sell at 60 days, which is the required minimum for raw milk cheeses to be aged.
You use only raw milk?
Only raw milk, yeah. We don't have a pasteurizer. So it's basically straight from the cow. And we milk directly into the cheese vat, basically, to make cheese in the morning. Our milk is never more than 24 hours out of the cow before it becomes cheese. That's just a thing.
But it's all grass-fed.
It is also all grass-fed, yeah. But just for the aging question, the blues we start selling at about 2 months, but they can go to 5 or 6. They just sort of just get more potent as they get older.
Mm-hmm.
The Gruyere or the Alpine and the Raclette, the Valais, can go up to a year, if not more. The cheddars can go, you know, they can go 4 years as long as they're, we haven't kept one for that long, but
nice to try. Have a little special reserve. Max Breitneicher is our guest from Grace Hill Farm in Cummington. We talk cheese here at 800-348-2551. After the break, we'll eat some cheese.
Gorgonzola, Parmesan, mozzarella, pickle crema, Danish bimbo, Czech sheep's milk, Venezuelan beaver cheese.
Not today, sir, no.
Ah, how about cheddar?
Well, we don't get much call for it round here, sir.
Not much it's the single most popular cheese in the world.
Not round here, sir.
And what is the most popular cheese round here?
Ilchester, sir.
Is it?
Oh, yes, sir. It's staggeringly popular in this manor, sir.
Is it?
It's our number one bestseller, sir.
I see. Ilchester, eh?
Right, sir.
All right. Eh? Have you got any? He asked, expecting the answer no.
I'll have a look, sir.
It's not much of a cheese shop, is it?
Finest in the district, sir.
Explain the logic underlying that conclusion, okay?
Well, it's so cheesy, sir.
It's certainly uncontaminated by cheese.
You haven't asked me about limbo, sir.
Is it worth it?
Could be.
Have you shut that bloody bazooki up?
Told you, sir.
Have you got any Limburger?
No.
Here we go.
Support for WAMC comes from Spirit House Amherst, Massachusetts, a family-owned wine, beer, and spirits retailer offering organically farmed wines from around the world. Wine tastings, Saturday afternoons, spirithaus.com. Fort Hill Auto Body, Amherst, Massachusetts, locally owned and operated since 1997, providing auto body repair, detailing, painting, and glass replacement, a proud supporter of public radio, forthillautobody.com. Flurry Lumber, Route 10, East Hampton, providing advice and assistance for projects small and large, items such as Benjamin Moore paints, hardwood flooring, Anderson windows, Trex decking, tools, lumber, hardware, flurrylumber.com. Gloriosa & Company, Ashfield, Massachusetts, planning and catering weddings, showers, reunions, and other gatherings indoors or out at the Curtis House with 3 rooms available or at a variety of venues around the area, gloriosaco.com. And Upstate Divorce Mediation, specializing in divorce mediation and collaborative divorce, helping couples who are seeking a legal separation or divorce, offices in Albany, Saratoga, and Catskill, upstatedivorcemediation.com.
Welcome back to Vox Pop. It's a Food Friday. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Max Breitneicher of Grace Hill Farm in Cummington, Massachusetts is our guest. We're talking about making cheese, and we'll eat some cheese here. What did you bring?
So what we're going to try right now, we actually brought a little three-course cheese lunch here. Oh,
fantastic.
First and foremost, we have our Alpine, or what I'll call Wild Alpine, which is it's close to a Gruyere style, which means it's sort of a relatively long-aged Alpine-style cheese.
One of my favorite types of cheese.
Yep, me too. So it's going to be a little bit nutty, a little bit dry. And the way that we're serving it to you right now is on apples
from
a place called Apex Orchards in Shelburne, Mass., which
is try
our friends. And it is also covered with turmeric honey from our friends at Old Friends Farm in Amherst. And they grow the turmeric and make the honey there.
That's a perfect combination.
I know. It works so well. Generally, the Alpine types, and Gruyere in particular, mix really well with fruit because they have a lot of sort of floral and nutty notes.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is...
Is that a tough cheese to make?
It's relatively complex, at least in terms of the types that we make.
All right, take us through the process. Again, at the beginning of the show, I said this was a mystery to me. I know, you learn in chemistry class there's enzymes involved, and frankly, once I glazed over once they said enzymes. So tell us how you make cheese.
Sure. The process for making any type of cheese, generally, outside of a few really extreme cases, is almost entirely the same. And you're just doing minor variants on that process to create different types of cheese. And so the way that it happens, the generalized process, is that get a bunch of milk, you add starter culture to it, which is the bacteria types and mold types that you want to exist in the cheese.
Where do you get that?
We order them from France primarily.
Okay. Italy. Yeah. And when they first made cheese, how did they stumble upon this?
Yeah, so this is actually really interesting. And so we get our cultures freeze-dried from these big producers in France. But the way that they have those cultures is they basically ended up swabbing the walls of various caves where people had just been aging cheese forever. And so that is actually what makes the different cheese types. That's where they came from.
Really?
And that people would just make a cheese and they would stick it in a cave in Provence or whatever, and it would grow this type of bacteria on it. But also when they just had the milk out as they were making the cheese, it would absorb whatever like ambient bacteria there was in the environment. And so these culture types are isolated from just like natural strains that were from Europe primarily.
Are there any domestic strains that have a unique Massachusetts sort of
I mean, there certainly is.
Terroir?
I don't think anyone's gone out of their way to isolate them.
No?
I mean, it's a pretty complex thing. You need a laboratory, basically, in order to do that in a safe way. And as far as I know, there aren't any U.S. companies that do that.
Oh, very
But
very
you could. Like, we could have, like, a particular Cummington bacteria if we wanted to.
Yeah, well, I'm sure there's a bacteria around the studio if you'd like to make a double.
I'll swab the walls before I go.
It'll be the first time. Let's go to Mike in Loudonville. Mike, you're on.
Yes, I'm looking for a washed curd cheddar cheese. Hmm. It was popular in the western part of the state, also known as shingle house cheese.
Explain to me what a washed curd cheese is.
Curd through a extra wash process that makes it very moist. Mm-hmm. Even an aged cheese is moister than most. More moist than most.
Absolutely. I've never heard of people doing that with cheddar. I mean, I thought that I'm not 100% on this, but I thought that's how they made Monterey Jack, was they just washed the curds from cheddar. But like, you know, our valet, which is a raclette style that we're about to eat, is also a washed curd cheese. And yeah, it makes it a lot mellower and a lot higher moisture
content. How do you wash the curd?
Basically, as you're draining out the whey when you have the curd, usually just drain a percentage of the whey, 20%, and then you replace it with a certain amount of water, 15 or 20%.
As I remember, they drain most of the whey and then subjected it to a wash.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know anyone who's making that, but I mean, that would definitely be worth looking up.
A person tried in Western New York a couple years ago, but it wasn't really very tasty.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you could also try it home and just see what happens, And that is basically the process, is taking out, you can even, the less whey you take out, the less the effects are going to be. So you could start with just removing 20% of the whey, adding 50% water, and just test it out.
I mean, isn't making cheese at home sort of a recipe for violent stomach cramps? No?
Not necessarily.
No, can do it?
You can do it, yeah. People do it all the time. And there are a number of ways to make it sort of safe.
It's funny. There were about 5 cheese factories out there one time that made it.
Huh.
Weird.
And now, I called the New York State Cheese Association.
Oh, yeah, those guys.
And they had no idea what I was talking
about.
Wow.
That's funny.
All right, Mike, well, maybe this is a Loudonville thing. You ought to do this yourself. Well, thanks for the call. Right.
Thank you.
Have a good weekend. 800-348-2551. Max Breitenreicher, our guest from Grace Hill Farm in Cummington. We're eating and talking cheese today. Let's go to Jennifer in Pownell, Vermont. Jennifer.
Hi, I'm a homesteader milking just one little Devon cow, but I end up having to make quite a few types of cheese to use all her milk. I am making it with the raw milk. And I am curious about the bandaging method for dressing my cheddars. I've had bad luck with the waxing, drying them for a few days on all sides, rubbing them with a little salt, or possibly even wiping them down with vinegar. None of those things seem to prevent various discoloration underneath the wax when I go to peel them. And so I'm curious if I'd have better luck with that bandaging, that cloth wrapping, and how I would go about doing that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we cloth bind our cheddars. That's how we deal with those.
Would I have trouble keeping the 2-pound wheels I'm making moist enough? Or what's the method to hold the moisture in?
That's going to depend entirely upon where you're aging them. In
our natural cellar, which runs, I never let it get over 50 before putting them in a a high set fridge.
Sure, but it would depend more on the humidity of that
mm-hmm.
space. Yeah. So even if, depending on how big it is, you could just throw a humidifier down there and it'd probably be sufficient. I mean,
mm-hmm.
what you're looking and for long-term aging, I imagine you're not trying
yes, to. Yes, a year or more.
Okay, yeah. So for that, you're going to want to keep it at least 70% humidity consistently. I mean,
okay.
it can go below
so
it.
So once I've dried my cheddar,
yeah.
how do I proceed with
yeah, exactly.
that?
So the bandaging process is basically you're going to want to get a really fine mesh cheesecloth. I mean, I think
mm-hmm.
anything over 90, there you know, there are different grades of it. Anything over 90, and then you're essentially, you know, I assume it's a cylinder, and you're going to cut out a circle for the top, and
mm-hmm.
then you're going to paint that on. You can either use, you can use lard, which is the traditional method, like melted lard.
Boil.
Well, the lard itself will
go rancid.
Yeah, not really. Lard at low temperatures is sort of.
Can I use unsalted butter?
I would not use butter. No, that'll
okay.
definitely go rancid.
Lard.
Lard, and what we use actually, we've tried the lard in the past, and you know had sort of variable results because it's really breathable. But there's something called Dutch cheese wax, which is more of just a cheese coating, which is a wax that's. It's sort of liquid at room temperature,
mm-hmm.
so you don't have to melt it or anything. And it's also super breathable, and it's
mm-hmm.
just made from, like, cellulose or something. It's a very simple product. And there's actually a number of suppliers to get that from. But you can paint that on over the cheesecloth, and it creates an almost perfect barrier
perfect.
Against mold and stuff.
So you're winding a strip on
yep, exactly.
the outside to hold these two discs. On either end.
Yeah, exactly. One on the top, painted
okay.
on. One on the bottom, painted on. Then wrap one around the. Around
okay.
the side.
May I ask one other question?
Sure.
Yeah, sure.
Are you waxing your blue cheeses before caving them?
No, no. The cheddars are the only thing we put any coating on. Other than that,
okay.
it's just all natural rind.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you're
and welcome. Good luck with your venture. I read about you in the Hilltown Observer newspaper, I think.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And congratulations, and thank you for answering my question.
Thanks a lot. Yeah,
Jennifer, have
bye-bye.
A great weekend. Thanks for the call. The number to call here is 800-348-2551 here on this Food Friday. So we had great fun giving away your cheese during the fun drive. Jessica and I had a fun drive shift, and one of the days we gave away your cheese, and the comments that you had written for us to read, hilarious. But there was made mention of a cheese cave.
Hmm.
All right, explain your cheese cave.
So it's slightly misleading to call it a cave, though we like to call it that.
Oh, really? So it's not really it's a basement?
No. It's above ground. That's
okay.
why we wouldn't call it a cave.
Okay.
And yeah, it's part of our cheese facility. It's connected to everything. It's connected to our cheese room, basically. But it's a, you know, I would say 21 by 17 by 8-foot ceiling space that is just hyper-insulated and that we keep at about 50 degrees and about 80 to 90% humidity at all times.
80 to 90% humidity.
Yeah. And it's continuously ventilated. It's on this whole system to make it sort of an okay environment. Yeah.
So, okay, you're in the cheese cave. 20 years from now, will that cave have its own cultures on the wall?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it probably does already. It, you know, maybe a year or two from now, it'll be perfectly populated. But basically, we've had enough blue and enough of our mold-ripened cheese, which has something called geotrichum on the outside in there, that if you just put, you know, raw curd in there, it would grow blue mold and geotrichum.
Okay, and so the cheese, the hard cheese, and it's amazing. It looks like a blue, but it's quite a bit harder than that. So what is this cheese?
That's the blue, actually.
This is a blue cheese.
Jessica put it on your plate.
But it is a nice, it's a pretty firm consistency.
Yeah, our blue is relatively low moisture content, so it's not, you know, as wet as something like Gorgonzola Dolce or something like that.
Wow, but it's delicious.
It's a variant on that. So we try to, with the blue specifically, we try to sort of split the difference between it being creamy and it having a lot of character, which is often like a little bit different, creamy and dry and sort of like high taste and high blue content.
Maybe. So the veins are essentially mold, right?
Yeah, well, rather what's growing in the veins is blue mold, yeah, or Penicillium roqueforti, which is like the standard roquefort blue mold.
Mm.
And so when we're making the blue, this is actually a good chance to talk about it. When we're putting in the cheese cultures, we also add the blue mold to the milk before you even make the cheese. And then, you know, you make the cheese and then when it's about a week old, you pierce it with these needles. And wherever you put holes in, oxygen gets in, and the blue mold grows in the oxygen.
Makes sense.
Yeah, and so that's what makes the veins in blue cheese. Yeah.
So well, it really has a distinctive character. And you say there's some sort of lineage of Gorgonzola in this as well?
Sort of. I mean, basically, this is a cross between a Gorgonzola and something called a Stitchleton, which is like a traditional English blue. But it's also a little bit something called a Milawa, which is actually Australian, which is just this really particular cheese type. So anyway, as far as I know, the cheese species is sort of indigenous to our farm. Like, we invented it.
Basically. Oh, really?
Yeah, it's like you can't buy, as far as I know, another blue like this.
It certainly has a unique character.
Yeah, it's like
it's very good.
Yeah, thanks.
We may well consume some more. Let's take a call so I can consume some more. Let's go to Lynn. Lynn, you're on.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call. My daughter, do you know Kelly Jewell?
Kelly Jewell. Yeah, I feel like I totally know that name.
She's in Provisions.
Oh, yeah,
she's
Kelly,
a cheese monger like you.
I know Kelly. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I was just wondering, she gets this Vermont cheddar cheese, and it was not like the Vermont cheddar I used to know when I was, 30 years ago maybe. The stuff I was getting was at a very small country store, and it tasted differently than Cabot and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me anything about that?
I have no idea. Do you know the actual type of cheese that she was getting? Was it Cabot?
It's local. It does say Cabot on it, really. Okay. But most of her cheese comes from, she knows all these people over the New York, Holland, all these people all over the place. And
yeah, sure. Yeah, no, she seems super knowledgeable. That's really true, and we've dealt with her.
Yes. She knows a lot of people. What's your name again?
My name is Max.
Max Brightner.
Max.
Yep. Grace Hill Farm in Cummington. Lynn, thank you so much for the call. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. 1-800-348-2551. So the cows, they're happy cows. They're smart cows. Are they listening now?
I don't know.
We shout out to the cows?
That's a good question.
No?
Yeah.
But they eat only grass.
They eat only grass.
So when we have a large, some of the larger, maybe in the Midwest, cheese producers, are they grain-fed cows?
Yeah, I mean, any real production dairy typically would grain feed their cows, and not necessarily just grain.
Why, though? Is it just a cost issue?
There's a number of reasons, but the primary reason that people do that is because it dramatically increases their growth and milk production over a very short period of time. Because there's so much more energy, readily available within grains as opposed to just grass. But the reason why we don't do it is that also comes with a lot. As with a lot of production agriculture, like when you're getting a lot more out of something, it comes with a lot of risks and drawbacks.
And risk to the animals. Yeah.
Well, somewhat. Yeah. I mean, certainly it has risks for making cows quite sick, yeah. And essentially the reason for that is when you're feeding a lot of grain, specifically corn and soybeans, which is what they feed, the cows aren't really evolved to digest that much starch at one point.
Mm-hmm.
They're evolved to digest a lot of grass, basically, where they break apart the cellulose into the different things that they need. So excess starch, which isn't really extant in just pasture and forage, it builds up in their rumen, which is the second stomach chamber where a lot of the digestion happens. And it basically builds this like frothy layer in that. And it radically can acidify that environment. And so cows' systems are balanced roughly to really help them deal with things, sort of pathogenic bacteria that are in the soil and around, like E. coli and Listeria and things like that. And when you're raising the pH of their system, because those pathogens are acid-loving, they tend to survive better and can really cause problems for the cow, but also it's a lot more likely it'll come out in either the milk or the meat.
This is interesting. Now, you said that before we started that you have a rotational system, mm-hmm. with regard to where your cows feed on the property.
Yep.
And you had reasons for that are quite beyond me at this point. Now, first of all, it's to be noted that this is raw milk.
Sure.
And so you have to be extra careful of the stuff that goes in and comes out, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, that's one of the reasons why we do exclusively grass-fed, is that when you don't, when the cows sort of have a just grass diet, it's really uncommon for pathogens like E. coli to be able to even live in them. So even if they ingest something that has it, their systems usually kill it because it's not capable of living below a certain pH, and or above a certain pH, sorry. And so that just grass feeding as long as the rest controlling for everything else, just grass feeding essentially eliminates that risk within raw milk.
So the rotational feeding plays into this as well, right?
Yeah, well, rotational grazing, it has sort of threefold effects. The number one reason why we do it is that it's just, well, probably tied for number one, is that it just is really good for the pasture. So moving cows, we move cows roughly every 12 hours to a new paddock within, you know, a little strip.
Do you have a calendar and you say, well, you're in sector B today?
yeah.
Really?
Sector 7G.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, more or less, yeah. A lot of it's in my head, but it's all drawn out. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, we move them roughly every 12 hours. And when cows are just put on one spot within, like if you just leave them in a big field.
Yeah.
You know, depending on how big the field, but they tend to just eat the things that they like. Like cows have preferences primarily for things like white clover, red clover, you know, like orchard grass, a bunch of different things. And so, you know, there'll be whatever, 50, 60 species of grasses within a field, and the cows will just keep eating the things that they like. And when animals eat the cotyledons, so you eat grass down, it starts to grow again, you know. But it's first putting out these little things called cotyledons, which contain a lot of protein and just the stuff that the plant uses. And so anyway, cows, when they're just left somewhere, will eat it down. And then as soon as the cotyledons come up, they'll eat it again. And it basically will really stunt, decimate the things that they like, which generally leads to fields being overgrown with things that aren't that good, a.k.a. that cows don't prefer.
Okay. Then there's a reason that you brought up about not necessarily pathogens, but parasites.
Yeah, no.
Let's take a break. Yeah. It's break time, but then let's pick it up where we left off, and then we'll get back to the phones. 800-348-2551. Max Breitneicher is our guest. He is from Grace Hill Farm in Covington. We talk cheese. How can you lose, right?
Support for WAMC comes from Troy Waterfront Farmers Market, featuring local producer-only foods and products every Saturday, 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. inside the Troy Atrium, parking in the Uncle Sam Garage, troymarket.org. Cafe Capriccio, Chef Jim Rua, working to preserve and maintain the traditions of Italian cuisine and hospitality since 1982 on Grant Street in Albany, New York. CafeCapriccio.com. Bread and Butter, newly opened restaurant in North Amherst Mill District, offering breakfast and lunch daily from traditional staples to chef specialties such as duck confit hash and maple sriracha pork belly, breadandbutteramherst.com. The Waldorf School of Saratoga Springs, educating children pre-K through grade 12 and striving to inspire a lifelong love of learning, waldorfsaratoga.org. And Field Goods, delivering local produce every week from small farms all year long, pickups at workplaces and other locations, including all Hewitt's Garden Center locations, field-goods.com.
Welcome back to the program. It's Vox Pop on WAMC Food Friday. Oh, no, don't stop what you're doing, Max. Max Breitneicher of Grace Hill Farm, you're turning on something which may well burn the studio down. What is that?
I hope this outlet is grounded, right?
I think it is.
We're
in code.
We brought in something called a raclette machine.
A raclette?
Also called a raclette grill. And this is the thing that is used to melt the raclette-type cheese that we make. Ours is called Velay, It's raclette is basically like a really popular dish in Switzerland and northern France,
yeah.
Also in Germany, and it's sort of like a open faced fondue, I guess I would call it.
Had me at fondue, man.
So instead of melting the cheese in a big pot, you run it under these little broiling elements that essentially broils it, and then you scrape it off onto usually traditionally boiled potatoes, cured meats, and little toast.
All right, so you're cooking that. How long will that take?
It'll take like just a few minutes.
Okay, so we'll take a call or two. Now, if you're at home and you hear the fire alarm go, we'll send Max and everybody else out. I will stay, and I'll go down with the ship, and we'll continue the show. Let's go to Chris in Ballston Spa. Chris.
Hi. I'm calling to kind of ask you about cheddar cheese. I had purchased some. And it was just delicious, from a cheesemaker up in Pulaski. And he had cheddars that were aged like 18 years.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then it was delicious. But then another cheese place in Galway said, oh, that can't be so. And then on your show, you'd kind of mentioned that kind of a max of 4 years that cheeses are aged.
Oh, no, that's just for ours.
So you could, in theory, is there a law of diminishing returns after a certain number of years?
I don't know. It depends. I mean, they're often...
Oh, it was delicious.
They're often, you know, like the Beemster Goudas and stuff can be sold at 20, 22 years.
Wow.
It's not unheard of. And you can
Is it like a port where you have an aged 30-year port and it's so much better than the 10-year port?
Mm-hmm. And so basically what happens as whatever sort of, you know, a low-moisture cheese like cheddar or Gouda ages is the sugars in it, whatever remains in that are sort of going to caramelize.
It did have a nutty taste.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
granularness to
totally,
it.
Totally. Yeah, yeah. It'll be granular and like a little bit like caramel. Specifically with Gouda, that happens really pronounced. But the only things that dictate the amount of time that you can age a wheel of cheese is it's primarily just its size. The larger the wheel, the longer you can age it. And you know, most places that are aging for long periods they'll have 70 or 80 pound wheels.
Wow.
Wheels of cheese, where ours are 10, you know? So it's that, and it's also as long as the environment is completely consistent. So you're going to need to have high moisture and relatively low temperature for all the time for it to make it that long. But yeah, those are the only things. And, you know, theoretically, you could age a cheese indefinitely. You could age it for...
What's the oldest cheese ever discovered?
Actually, this is something I was reading about recently. They unearthed some tomb in Israel, and there was... Yeah, it was like a 5,000-year-old cheese in there or something.
So, you break out the Ritz crackers and go to town? What happens?
Yeah, no, I think they ate it.
Okay, fair. Yeah. Hey, Chris, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Bye. 800-348-2551. All right, how's the raclette coming along,
you know,
old boy?
It's on the way. We're waiting for it to just start to brown on the top, which it's almost doing.
All right, let's take a call then. Do we have time to take another one while we're...
Okay,
while we're cooking. Nova in Buckland, Mass. You're on.
Hi, hello. I was listening to that phone call from that woman who was talking about cheddar cheese. Mm-hmm. And I lived in Ashfield. And, that a wheel of cheddar cheese in here that tasted totally wrong, totally different from any cheddar cheese I've ever tasted. It was delicious. It was sharp. What do you say about that?
No idea.
First of all, let's say hi to Lynn in Shelburne Falls again. Hello, Lynn. Thank you very much. We appreciate it. All right, go ahead. What do you think?
I really don't know, but that sounds great. I mean, it just sounds really good.
Terrific. Let's go to Kathy in Niskayuna. Kathy, you're on.
Oh, hi. Just have a couple of questions real quick, and I'll listen off the air.
Okay.
It's about, different methods to how to serve cheese. I know, a semi-soft, hard, like letting it breathe. Mm-hmm. And, how to take it out of the fridge in time for a dinner party kind of thing.
Sure.
And the second one is we were actually in France, and I know that serving cheese with like a fig preserve or some kind of fruit preserve was really popular there.
Yeah.
And we had one with like fabulous like black cherry and, just recommendations for those, what pairs well with that. And also, just the question about serving cheese.
Yeah.
So. I'm going to listen off the air.
Okay, Kathy, thank you. Have a good weekend.
Yeah, totally. I mean, what we do typically is I'll take a fridge out of, or take a cheese out of refrigeration at least an hour before serving it, at least. Like sometimes 2 hours. And so it'll usually come, either wrapped in plastic or in cheese paper or whatever. So you take it out of the fridge 2 hours before you're going to serve it, and then take it out of whatever wrapping it's in an hour before you're going to serve it. That's more than sufficient time for it to. And all you're trying to do is you're trying to get any sort of ammonia or whatever it's been breathing into that, especially with plastic wrap, it'll breathe ammonia out.
Oh, interesting.
So you take the wrap off so that it can get rid of that, and you're just trying to bring it to room temperature, which is typically the way you would serve cheese. Like, or at least in Europe, cold cheese is not really a thing. It's like, it'd be weird to eat cold,
cold beer is not always a thing in Europe either.
Yeah, exactly.
The cheese, it does taste better.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not going to say it. You sliced the cheese well prior to the show, and I tried it then. It's better now.
Yeah, it gets better as it breathes. I mean, same with wine or whatever, It's like it just needs time to sort of adjust to itself.
Hmm. Yeah. This whatever you call this blue cheese is just
it's called Hilltown Blue.
So good. All right, let's go to Joan in Gilderland. Joan, you're on.
Hi there. I've been diagnosed lactose intolerant a long time ago, and I've been trying, sampling sometimes cheeses that I was able to tolerate. When I lived in Europe, I seemed to have a better time of it. And I wondered if there's a difference, if you can answer, you know, if there's a difference between the European treatment of cheese and American treatment, and if you can recommend cheeses for the lactose intolerant, if I miss it.
Yeah, sure. And yeah.
Soy ain't the same.
Yeah. I want to make it very clear that I'm not a doctor of,
okay,
any, of anything.
And it's clear that he's not a doctor.
But especially of any sort of medical science.
He's not even a vet, even though he spends time around cows.
Yeah, but in my opinion, the reason why it was easier for you to eat European cheeses as opposed to American is that they're almost exclusively raw milk cheeses. Yeah, mm-hmm. And you know, in the U.S. it's a lot more common for it to be pasteurized milk cheese. And the reason I would say that is that raw cow's milk, as with all other raw mammals' milk, contains the enzymes in it that digest, you know, the sugars and proteins and stuff, specifically lactose. And so usually some people who will be think that they're lactose intolerant or have that experience are actually just intolerant to, like, pasteurized milk products. And, you know,
like, in other words, what I did experience is I can eat butter.
Yeah.
And I've never understood why, what the difference is, but it seems to me that it's something about the additive, not the actual milk that's causing this, right?
Oh, it could be that too. And also, I've had the experience that some people who think, oh, that's good to go, Jessica, if you want to put it on.
Okay.
Some people who think that they have a lactose allergy actually have a allergy to really common types of cheese cultures, like the cultures that you put into the milk to make the cheese. And it's just sort of, they're never separate, so you don't really know. But in something like butter, that would be a good indication that might be true, because butter doesn't have those cultures usually. And if it is cultured, it doesn't have the typical cheese type cultures.
So there you go.
Yeah. So anyway, that might just be someone to check out and to see if there's any difference when you play with that.
Yeah, the question would be whether you can recommend certain kinds of cheese that might not have those cultures, can you point me in a direction?
Yeah, I'm not really sure. I mean, typically with you want to put the crowd on that?
Oh,
sorry.
My heavens.
But typically people don't actually divulge, especially on labels. Like if you called the company, they might divulge what kind of cultures they use in the cheese, because it's sort of like considered a trade thing. I'm not really sure what I would recommend, but in general,
all I can say is that I have been told the softer cheeses, such as the Brie or things that are not, you know, hardened, maybe and I'm not familiar with the Gorgonzolas that you were talking about earlier, but or the blue cheeses. But if you could recommend soft cheeses, that might be better.
Hmm. Yeah, no, it's possible. Yeah.
Or a source where I could buy them.
Generally we just get cheese at any sort of good cheesemonger, like even like Whole Foods or something has a pretty good cheese counter. Generally I would just recommend trying raw milk and, you know, relatively aged cheeses and just see if that helps.
Aged, do you say?
Yeah, I would say more aged, yeah.
Well, Joan, thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you so much. Yep.
Thanks. I know. 800-348-2551. Max Breitenreiter, what the heck did I just eat? Because it's really, 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 really good.
Oh, it's amazing. Huh?
While you were talking to Joan, Jessica brought over a plate, and it's bread with cheese and some kind of kraut. It's really, really delicious.
Yeah.
What
so,
is it?
So this is what they call raclette, which is the meal I was talking about that's really popular. So it's got our melted Valais cheese, which is a raclette style on the top. And it's over some, like, black Baltic rye bread.
Delicious bread, too.
On top of the rye bread, we have cured meats from Sutter Meats in Northampton.
Fantastic.
This is an amazing butcher shop. They just do fantastic work. And actually, so what we have for the meat is lamb bacon and lamb pastrami.
Oh, my gosh.
And the lamb is from our next-door neighbor, Kyle. Kyle.
Really?
Farrer. Yeah, at Splendor View Farm. A little shout-out to them. Come to Mass. And Kyle also makes our hay. He's just a fantastic guy. But anyway,
hay.
Yeah, he makes our hay.
Oh, we don't.
So anyway, they also raise grass-fed lamb. So this is lamb bacon and lamb pastrami.
This is one of the greatest things I've ever eaten.
I know, it's really
and
good.
I'm not exaggerating.
It's really good. And then on top of that, usually they eat it with some sort of pickles or something, but we chose a garlic sauerkraut from Real Pickles in Greenfield, Mass., also friends of ours, who just make fantastic lacto-fermented whatnot.
Which I have never had garlic sauerkraut before. And
right.
I love sauerkraut, but this is something else.
It's really good.
Wow, okay. Right. Well, you won a prize. You get to come back on the show.
Right, yeah.
Let's go to Bess in Gilderland. Bess, you're on.
Yes. Hello.
Hello.
How do I know when the small pieces of cheese that I wrap in saran and put in my refrigerator are not good to eat? Sometimes, of course, they get a little green fuzz or white fuzz on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
I scrape it off, and I don't know if it's beyond good or what? So how can I tell?
I'd say generally with things that are in your fridge, it's not, there's nothing in there unless you have like spilled a ton of meat juice or something in your fridge. It's not, it's never going to be risky to scrape the mold off of cheese. That's, I believe that wholeheartedly.
Okay. Meat mold is not good?
Well, I mean, if you spilled like raw hamburger juice in there or something and it had E. coli in it, like that could, could have possibly cross-contaminated. It would have had to touch it. But generally, I will save cheese in the fridge basically just until it's super dry and you don't want to eat it anymore. Yeah.
Can I scrape the white stuff and the green stuff off and the cheese underneath is still edible?
Oh, yeah. 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 Typically, that's totally true. And usually, I would say the white stuff, if you store any amount of cheese, of soft cheeses like a Brie or Camembert, the white stuff is going to be something called Geotrichum candidum, which is a completely harmless white mold. And the blue stuff could quite possibly be blue mold if you ever had blue cheese in there.
This is on hard cheese, like cheddars or the Gruyere's or something that I've just kept too long in the drawer.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, those molds will grow on anything. I would again, I'm not a doctor at all.
No, you're not. Our legal department says, consult your own scientist on this.
Just eat it all.
I can taste it and make my own decision. Huh?
Yeah, exactly.
And if you live, call us back next show.
All right.
Thanks, Bess. Thank you. We appreciate it. 1-800-348-2551. You see the questions you get on this program? By the way, before we go any further, I want to give a shout out to my daughter, Greta, who is a cheese fanatic. And she's actually tuning in. One of those rare occasions when she listens to Daddy work. It's very nice. It has been so much fun, and the cheese is so good. We didn't even drink the booze you brought.
I know. Well, you can have some of the bourbon and blue. And so our final pairing was going to be a rye whiskey from Hudson Whiskey. A little bit.
Okay.
Hudson Whiskey, and they're in what? What's the place? Gardner? Gardner, New York.
Gardner, and they've been on.
Yeah. They make great stuff. I've never met those guys, but they just seem really good. And it pairs, whiskey, especially bourbon and rye, pairs really well with blue cheese. And in part because the sweetness mixes really well with the pungency of blue. They just work together well with the smokiness and all that. It's a great pairing. And I would say just a wonderful dessert. And, maybe with a cigar or something. I assume smoking.
Do you store cigars in the cave?
No.
No?
Just cheese.
Okay.
I think the FDA would frown upon that.
Okay, but I mean the humidor. It's like a humidor, right?
It is sort of like a humidor.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Greg in Amherst. Greg.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Question about cheddar cheese. I've been making blue cheeses for some time now, and I moved on to cheddar cheese at one point, and I went through the cheddaring process, and everything was fairly successful, and I went to wax the cheese, and I felt like the process had gone actually really well up to that point, and I had the cheeses down in the basement, and I was turning them regularly, but then they started to develop soft spots under the wax.
Mm. Yeah.
And I'm not sure why.
Yeah, absolutely. That's something that can happen. And I would say that either, A, the rind wasn't dry enough before you waxed it. And typically what we would do is we would air dry the rind in a non-cave environment, so a non-humid environment, or non-humid and cold for even up to 5 days, if not a little more. Because you just want to make sure that there's as little moisture on that as possible, because that will encourage mold growth underneath the wax when you wax it. Or there was some sort of quite aggressive mold on the rind already that you didn't notice because it wasn't actually growing until you put it in that sort of anaerobic environment of closing it off.
Okay.
But anyway,
if we're making breads at home too, and there's a lot of yeast in the kitchen already, is that likely to cause problems?
Oh yeah. If you're doing the same spot, and actually yeasts and cheese really sort of aggressively cross-populate each other, and so it's really, at least for any sort of production cheese making, like you can't have a bakery or anything even close to the facility because it'll just cause a mess. So that could also be part of it. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, thanks for the call. We appreciate it, Greg. We only have about 30 seconds here. Tell you what, Gene and Taconic, you only have about 20 seconds to ask this question. Performance anxiety, eh? Well, that's all right. That'll be the show. All right, you guys have a website?
We do. It is gracehilldairy.com. And on there is our email and stuff. And so if anyone has like further questions or whatever, feel free to email me and I can email them back.
What's next for Grace Hill in 2016? Anything new? Any new cheese on the horizon? No Velveeta type products, clearly, right?
Spray cheese is what we're getting into.
Oh, good. Oh, great. I love that.
It's the most fun. But yeah, we're going to probably start making a feta this year, which is a cheese type that
Beautiful.
I really like.
Yeah.
And, you know, we'll see what happens. But primarily, we're just raising our beautiful 7-month-old son, Charlie, right now.
Well, so. Best to you and your wife, Amy, and your son. And we appreciate everything you've done for us in the fund drive and being here today. Support for WAMC comes from Tom McRae, Edward Jones Financial Advisor on University Drive, Amherst, Massachusetts. Member SIPC, Edward Jones, making sense of investing. EdwardJones.com/Tom McRae. Shire City Sanctuary presenting dance instructions and a swing dance, too, on February 27th with music by Lucky Five, ShireCitySanctuary.com. Sutter Meats, King Street, Northampton, providing fresh local pasture-raised beef, pork, and lamb. Additional house-made items, including rotisserie chickens, bone broths, bacon jam, and handmade sausages, SutterMeats.com. And Blue Heron Restaurant and Catering, offering full-service catering at the restaurant in Sunderland and throughout western Massachusetts. BlueHeronDining.com/catering. Thanks again to Max Breitneicher for being with us today. Thanks for listening. Thanks for the great calls. Thanks to Zach Malloy at the controls. Your phone's answered by Barb King. Our producer, Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Ray Graff. Thanks for being here this week. Next week, Alan will be in the chair on Monday for a Medical Monday.